I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Walter Wallace Jr. was buried this weekend after hundreds of mourners attended his funeral in North Philadelphia. He was shot and killed by two Philadelphia police officers 2 weeks ago who had been called to the home because of a family disturbance. The police department released excerpts of the body cam video, which is disturbing and graphic. The police arrive at the house. Walter Wallace, who had a history of mental illness, emerges carrying a knife. The police tell him numerous times to drop the knife, and a woman is heard yelling, "He's mental. He's mental." Wallace walks out into the street toward the police officers with a knife. One is heard saying, "Shoot him," and they both do more than a dozen times. He later died at a local hospital. It was just 1 minute between the time the police arrived and when the fatal shooting occurred. A bystander video that sparked protest and this video have raised a whole host of questions about police involved killing a black man, about training, and the treatment and needs of people with mental illness. We have three guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Mark Lamont Hill joining us by Skype. He's a professor of communications at Temple University, host of BET News and Coffee and Books, owner of Uncle Bobby's Bookstore, which is in Philadelphia. And he's got a brand new book called We Still Here, Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. Mark Lamont Hill, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always good to be here.
And Zakiya Williams joins us as well. She's co-founder and clinical program director of Black Men Heal, providing mental health treatment and psychological education to men of color. Zakiya Williams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. We will get her on. We're also joined by John White. He's CEO and president of the Consortium. That's a mental health crisis response center in Philadelphia. He's a former state representative, former Philadelphia City Council member, and former Pennsylvania Secretary of Welfare. And John White, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back.
Nice to have you back. Let me begin with you, if I could, John White, because I know you know this family. My understanding that Walter Wallace Jr. was known at the consortium, had been getting some therapy or some kind of counseling there. What can you tell us about how his family is doing?
Well, of course, these are very trying and difficult times for the family. They still have so many questions as to whether or not the police had to shoot and to kill him in this manner, and they're still puzzled as to why.
You have emergency groups that can go out to deal with situations like this. I do want to talk about what we see in the video, but if your organization had been called and you had sent people to the house, to the Williams house, what would have been done?
Well, Mr. Wallace had just been with us on Friday before the shooting for a therapy session. And the other members of the family were also known to us. And so we feel certain that if someone from the consortium had been present to help to try to de-escalate the situation, we may have had a totally different result. Last year, there were 1,200 such calls to the emergency hotline that came to our attention. And of those 1,200, we were either able to seek hospitalization or de-escalate the situation. But out of those 1,200, there were only six incidents that involved police.
Wow.
Since September, we've had 260 emergency calls of this nature. And there's only been one incident involving the police. So the expertise of our crisis team is proven to have been effective. And we are so saddened that we didn't get an opportunity to be of assistance to that family and, quite frankly, to the citizens of Philadelphia in like situations.
I want to pick up on all that you said, but let me get Mark Lamont Hill in on the conversation. And we're talking about Walter Wallace Jr. Mark, I looked at the video, I mean, in part in preparation for the show, but also because I think it's important to see these things as disturbing and graphic and revealing as they are. What do you see in this video that was released by the police department?
You know, I have to watch it both for my job and also as a citizen. and as someone who studies both video and state violence, the use of video and also covering state violence, and in all those ways, I should be used to this. It should be ordinary to me. And it was stunning. It was unsettling. It was disturbing. And I think one of the most disturbing things is the fact that his mother is pleading for help.
Yeah.
That the primary de-escalation tactics that are happening in terms of pleading with the police, in terms of trying to find a way to make the situation more manageable, is happening from citizens and not law enforcement. But I think that what we see in the video is almost less interesting and less significant than what we don't get to see, as has been said many times before. And even today, you know, the mother calling for support multiple times before, even that Monday, calling and saying, hey, I need help. So there's a fundamental challenge I think we have in society, which isn't just how do police respond correctly or incorrectly to a situation, but rather what does it mean to have a society where the police are the only people we can call or the only people we think we can call when people are facing mental health crises or when there is a drug overdose or all these other situations. We seem to be in a world where we have one tool and that's a hammer. And so everything looks like a nail and we need to develop new tools. And so when I saw that video, it was just a reminder of just how painful and just how tragic and just how destructive it can be if we don't have the tools necessary to respond and to ultimately meet people's needs.
Well, let me pick up on that. Let me just say to our listeners, we're trying to figure out Zakiya Williams' line, and we'll get her in as soon as we can figure that out. But John White, let me go back to you. And speaking about new tools, what we have learned in the last couple of weeks is that not all police officers, for instance, in Philadelphia, have tasers. Neither of these police officers had tasers, or perhaps another tool that they could have used to kind of de-escalate the situation. Can you speak to that?
Yes. First of all, personally, as I grew up in West Philadelphia, five blocks from where the incident took place, first of all, I don't understand why they would put police officers on the street and the only way that they can, quote unquote, protect themselves if they feel threatened is with a gun. No taser, no batons. Secondly, the failure really is in the communication between the police and the mental health agencies that respond to these crises. There was no need for that to happen. There were three calls to that family, to that house by the police. Both, the first two were domestic disturbance. This third call was for an ambulance. Police were sent. No ambulance was available in that particular neighborhood. And so the brother is absolutely right. We're sending these police officers out without the proper tools to protect lives. The inability or the failure to communicate information relative to crisis services is really appalling. All that is a directive from the commissioner directing police officers and district commanders to make sure that they have the information, the phone numbers of the various mobile crisis units. There's a city hotline for mental health emergencies. Our clinic is six blocks away from where it took place. It took place at 61st and Locust. Our offices are located at 55th and Chestnut Street. The two police officers who were involved in this shooting were unfamiliar with us, and we were unfamiliar with them. They were new to that area, new to that district, and again, put on the street with limited tools, certainly not enough tools to handle this situation in a much more humane manner.
And I want to pick up on that again. I just want to get Zakiya Williams in on the conversation. She's co-founder, clinical program director of Black Men Heal. And Zakiya Williams, nice to have you with us on Radio Time. Sorry about some of the technical issues this morning, but nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Don't worry.
You're very
about
welcome.
Challenged. So
don't even worry about it. I was talking with Mark Lamont Hill and John White about the video of what happened 2 weeks ago, Walter Wallace Jr. being shot by Philadelphia police officers. I'm assuming you've looked at the video, but I'm wondering if you have what you see. And I'm also wondering about just the trauma of seeing one of these videos after another, the trauma on the viewer as they look at what happened in real life.
Right. So I was listening in to the doctors, and I personally did not watch the video. I have to train myself not to look at anymore. I think I'm at my capacity. I should be shocked. I should be saddened, but I don't want to say I'm immune to it because I'm not, but I personally try not to bring that type of, to re-traumatize myself. But just listening to the doctors, it was just so disheartening because, you know, two things on a professional side and a personal side. On the personal side, I had my youngest brother is diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar. And this same scenario almost happened 2 weeks prior. He was having a psychotic episode. Someone in the community, you know, we're born and raised in North Philly. Someone from the community called my father, but someone else called the police. And when my father got there, he was trying to restrain my brother, and the cops got there and had their hands on the guns, telling my father to move out of the way, which he refused to do. So, you know, eventually it calmed down, and but it could have ended exactly the way Walter Wallace did. So, you know, it really hurts me on the personal side. But on the professional side, we do have an organization called Black Men Heal, and we don't take these emergencies, we don't take men in crisis. Frankly, we don't have the resources to do so. But it's just a huge vacuum between, you know, men who can control their mental health and they can wait on our list to get a doctor or a therapist, or in the men who's just in full-blown crisis. And, you know, Dr. Mark was exactly right. The first thing that people do is to call 911, because, to be honest, that's what we did. You know, we called, we got my brother 302. They had him in charge of his own, like, directing his own care. So when I, you know, he got to the hospital, I tried to call. They're telling me, well, we can't speak to you because he has to give us permission. But he's in a full psychotic episode. You know,
and the 302 is a commitment.
Right. So then 3 days later, they discharge him. We have no idea where he is. He's roaming the street. So it's a continual cycle that happens all the time. Meanwhile, people are looking at me, you know, like, oh, well, you have this organization dedicated to the mental health of Black men, but we don't have the staff or the resources, frankly, to service men that's in deep in crisis.
Well, you know what? We've got so much we need to talk about. I'm up in a break, and let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. We're going to take a break. We've got some folks that want to join our conversation. We are talking about the fact that the Philadelphia Police Department released body cam footage of the shooting of Walter Wallace Jr. in Philadelphia. The shooting took place about 2 weeks ago. The footage was released last week, as well as a 911 call that sparked an incident of protests, the death of Mr. Wallace, raising a whole host of questions. Talking with Zakiya Williams of Black Men Heal, John White of the Consortium, Mark Lamont Hill of Temple University, and of Uncle Bobby's Bookstore. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss. Going, talking with Mark Lamont Hill, Zakiya Williams, and John White. Mark, if I can go back to you and picking up on what you said earlier, which is that if all you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. But also picking up on what Zakiya Williams and John White were saying about the fact that we you know, out of reflex, we call 911. We want the police to come in and maybe solve too many of the problems that we have. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I talk about in my new book, We Still Here, is sort of how we can think about the world in different terms, how we can develop what I refer to as an abolitionist imagination. That is to say, what does a world look like where police and prisons aren't the primary response to all of our social crises and contradiction, whether it's homelessness, whether it's mental illness, whether it's poverty, whether it's drug addiction? How can we think about this differently? Because quite frankly, if someone were chasing me down the street, or if I felt in physical harm or threat, I would probably instinctively want to call the police. I mean, who else do I call, right? That's always the question. Who else do I call? But that the need for police emerge when we create a society that doesn't meet people's needs. Last year in Philadelphia, there was a huge conversation about safe injection facilities. And part of why there was, I think, such resistance to the idea of having SIFs in neighborhoods, other than the whole not in my backyard thing, where everybody likes them, they just don't want them in their neighborhood, is the question of, but drug users are bad people and bad people go to jail, right? We have a natural response to criminalize our crises. And so we have to reimagine that. If we take the stigma out of mental illness and we understand this as a health issue, then we can have a public health response rather than a criminalized response.
And John,
right. And as a provider,
John White, yeah, go ahead.
We're reviewing the situation to see why was it that, in spite of the extensive contact that we had with that family, why didn't they think to call us? Mm-hmm. And what we looked at is said, okay, do we really get the information out into our community, letting them know what to do in a crisis of this nature? What phone numbers do you call? So we're in the midst of now planning to do our part in exactly what the brother was just saying. We're going to have things that, you know, like those little magnets that you can put on your refrigerator, a simple phone number, what to do with the crisis, putting that information in areas where people gather, especially now coming up under the holidays. And I think we all know that there are any number of us who go through various stages of episodes or mental health, you know, issues during this period of time. But it's up to us as well to make sure that that information is available. The failure of the system is the lack of communication and, unfortunately, I believe also the lack of will to address this in the most appropriate manner.
Sure. And Zakiya, I want to get you back in on the conversation, but to you, John White, even going back to the incident, if, and again, I asked this before, but I'm interested in how mental health trained people could have then diffused the situation at Walter Wallace Jr.'s family's house with the interaction with him. From the time they arrived to the time they started shooting was about 60 seconds. But what are the tools? What are the ways that someone is helped when they're in the middle of some kind of a mental health crisis?
Our police officers are not trained in what we call mental health first aid. What to look for to anticipate that someone might be having a mental health issue, how to address them in that situation. And it doesn't make sense for them not to be trained. It ought to be that you have a mental health professional that helps distinguish those 911 calls to determine whether this is a criminal act or whether mm-hmm. this is someone who's in a mental health crisis. Police officers ought to be trained in the preliminary de-escalation techniques until a professional arrives. The dispatchers have to be able to triage those calls and know when it's a police action and when there's another type of professional that's needed for that particular scene in that particular situation. But the lack of will, it's the lack of will that is most disturbing, and it is the lack of respect that the system has for Black people that is sickening. This happens to us and in our community. And too often, the reasons, underlying causes of that not only go unidentified, they go unaddressed. And that's where all of us need to really come together and develop the will to change attitudes and behaviors.
Zakiya Williams, let me get you back in on the conversation because I know part of your organization, Black Men Heal, it deals with some of the stigma, some of the feelings of shame that can be associated with treating mental health services. And I don't think that's just related to African-American men. I mean, I think it's pervasive. But since we're talking about Walter Wallace Jr. and the impact of police-involved killings of Black men, I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yes, and I want to piggyback off of what both of them say, but especially what Dr. Mark said about the stigma of how we criminalize mental health or being on drugs or, you know, stuff like that. You know, Black Men Heal, that is one of the core missions of our movement, to erase the stigma of mental health in the Black community. The stigma does bring shame, and shame prevents connection. And if you don't have connection with other people, you feel isolated, and those feelings lead to emptiness, you know, hopelessness, and sometimes suicidal ideation. So what we do is what we require, and I don't want to say require, but we ask our men when they do our application process, is if you can share your experience of going through Black Men Heal with 8 other Black men, because we offered them 8 free mental health sessions with counseling sessions with clinicians of color. And so we asked them if they can share their experience with other Black men. And what we've noticed is that most of the people that come into our next cohort, because we do it by cohort, most of our men that come in by the next cohort are referred for men who went through the previous cohort. So we also have like fundraisers where each of our brothers get to speak about their mental health journey through Black Men Heal. And it's slowly but surely breaking down the stigma. You know, we started off our program with like 10 men in our cohort. Well, now we have over 100 men on our waiting list, which still is a bigger problem, because we would like to service them all, but we can't. You know, we don't have the resources to do so, or the clinicians to do so. But it is breaking down. We do notice that you know, like I said, the breaking down of the stigma amongst Black men. They're talking about it freely. And this is not a general assumption. I'm just talking about the numbers that we have through Black Men Heal. What our data is showing is that when they speak about it and normalize it, and it makes them feel comfortable. We created this space specifically for Black men so that they can have a safe space for them to talk about mental health issues.
I hear you. Mark Lamont Hill, you want to weigh in on that? Do we have Mark?
Yes. Okay. Sorry. As we talk about mental health and we intersect it with this conversation about law enforcement and state violence, I think that this has to be a conversation that's never disentangled. And the reason I say that is because, you know, every few months we have a conversation about tragically a Black man or woman who is beaten by the police or killed by the police, often unarmed, sometimes running away. We have these sort of awful, egregious cases, the George Floyds of the world, the Breonna Taylors of the world, the Ahmaud Arbery's of the world, with everyday citizens killing them. And those are tragedies, and they get a certain kind of attention because of the egregiousness of the violation. But that's one way to think about state violence. That's one way to think about police brutality. The more ordinary ways, the everyday ways that people end up in jail and prison, or everyday ways that people end up harmed by police, is often connected to mental illness. The George Floyds of the world happen occasionally. The Walter Wallace Juniors of the world happen every day. They don't get killed every day, but they certainly have encounters with law enforcement. They certainly are forced to navigate a world without social support. They don't have the benefit of accessing these wonderful agencies, or law enforcement doesn't access these agencies to draw the proper help. And so as a result, so many people in who are in state prison, so many people who are in county jail facilities, so many people who are in prison are there with mental illness. And the mental illness is often a prime reason why they're there. And we've seen this since, honestly, the end of the Carter administration, the beginning of the Reagan administration, when we shut down mental health facilities. And, you know, back in the day, people would be like, oh, they up in Byberry, you know. And now when you look all around the country, the Byberries are closed. The mental health facilities are closed, and people ended up on the street. And then these so-called tough-on-crime policies that ripped through our countries in the 80s and 90s made it illegal to be on the street. And so we essentially criminalized mental illness and homelessness, and, you know, which means we're criminalizing poverty. And all of these things intensify mental illness. They create new sites of trauma, and then you go to jail with trauma. And you come out with untreated trauma, which makes your circumstances even worse. And so this mental health conversation isn't just a side note or a rare intersection with the conversation about state violence. It is the conversation, and we need to be having it all the time.
Well, and John White, let me get you in on that. Before I worked in radio, I was part of that whole deinstitutionalization process as a case mm-hmm. manager. And the idea was, well, then you created community mental health centers. So, yeah. And I've been to Byberry. That was a horrible place. So you wanted a place that was closer to home that would provide the kind of community supports that people needed. But that, you know, that has not met the needs that are in the community.
Well, I think that I was involved. In fact, I initiated the closing of the Philadelphia State Hospital exactly the reason that you pointed out. Yeah. And rather than having one institution, we established beds in local hospitals, area hospitals, to try to assist with that. But when the community mental health services were expanded during the mid and late 80s, it was the full intent to not just to deal with the illness itself, but also the social supports, the determinants that lead to mental illness, that situation, the housing, the employment opportunities. So it really is it's a broader conversation that takes place within the state violence, within the mental health conversation. It's not just treating the mental illness. It is making sure that those who are treated have the ongoing supports through not just through the crisis, but through their ordinary living. Most people with mental illness are not episodic like that to a violent extent. Many are. But the whole stigma around mental health is something that we have been fighting against for decades. I've been at the consortium now for 19 years. Prior to that, as Secretary of Welfare, the advocates in the intellectually disabled community were forceful in demanding the type of services that they believed that their loved ones and family members who were intellectually disabled, could access. We closed Pennhurst and provided community-based services for those individuals so that they could live amongst the community and reach their fullest potential. That same advocacy did not exist and does not exist today when it comes to the mentally ill. Senator Hughes and his wife have fostered Breaking the Silence conferences annually. And it's one of the largest gatherings of mental health advocates and professionals in the city. That's been suspended, of course, because of COVID. But those efforts are ongoing to try to break that stigma. And it's continued to be a challenge because, like I said, you have to have the will. And I think sometimes in leadership, there's an absence of will and the courage necessary to make those changes.
Let me get some folks in on our conversation. That's John White, CEO and president of the consortium. Zakiya Williams, co-founder, clinical program director of Black Men Heal. And Mark Lamont Hill, professor at Temple University, host of BET's News and Coffee and Books, owner of Uncle Bobby's Bookstore in Philadelphia. And he's got a new book, We Still Here, Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. Bob from Lawrenceville has been very patient, waiting to join our conversation. And Bob, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for bringing attention to this issue, which transcends race, class, and geography. My sister, on September 17th last year, was shot to death in her own home in Henrico County, Virginia, by two police officers who had been sent by my sister's psychiatrist to perform a welfare check. The police officers were told by a neighbor when they arrived that my sister would not answer the door. She was afraid of the police. My sister had been to her psychiatrist the day before because the medicine for her bipolar was not working the way it should. The psychiatrist tried to call my sister the morning that she was killed. My sister didn't answer, so the psychiatrist called the police non-emergency line, asked for a welfare check, told them she did not believe my sister posed a threat to herself or others. When the cops arrived, they circled her house. They entered her house without permission. My sister had retreated to her bedroom. They broke down the bedroom door. At that point, she was hiding in her bathroom. They shoved in the bathroom door. She came out, and they shot her to death.
In her own home. I am so sorry, Bob.
She was an upper-middle-class white woman, 57 years old, 5'3" tall. When the police, we, when we found out later the police entered her bedroom with their guns drawn, and they justified this by saying, "We were afraid she might have hurt herself." The cop who fired the fatal shots had a taser on him, but because his gun was drawn, he could not use it. So this is a situation where, this, as I said, this transcends all class, race, geography.
Yes, it does.
The Washington Post has been tracking fatal police shootings for the past 5 years. Once every 37 hours in this country, a person with mental illness is shot dead by the police. What's the most extraordinary thing about this is we found out, talking to lawyers afterwards, that the protocol for the non-emergency number in this county is to send the nearest patrol car, even though the county has a crisis intervention team. If the dispatcher had called the crisis intervention team, this would not have happened, because that team had been sent to my sister's house on previous occasions and had helped her, not killed her. Anytime a welfare check turns into a murder, a homicide, something's seriously wrong.
I'm so sorry, and I'm sure everyone listening to you feels the same way. We're almost up in a break here, but John White, it sounds like you wanna say something to Bob from Lawrenceville.
He is absolutely correct. I'm sorry for your loss. It's painful in a situation when you know in your heart that it didn't have to happen that way. But it does speak to training, the lack of training in the law enforcement arena is painful in situations like this, because proper training can help mitigate those circumstances. And I'm sorry that it didn't happen appropriately with you and your family.
Bob, thank you so much for calling into Radio Times. We're going to take that very short break and then get back to our conversation, talking about a whole host of things related to the police shooting of Walter Wallace Jr. This was in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago, shot and killed, and he was struggling with mental illness at the time. John White with us, Akia Williams, Mark Lamont Hill. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just very quickly recap what we're talking about. Walter Wallace Jr., who was fatally shot by two Philadelphia police officers last month, was buried this past weekend. Hundreds of people attended his funeral. The Philadelphia Police Department released body cam video of the shooting. It shows a chaotic scene, and Wallace, who had a history of mental illness, he also had a knife, being shot within 1 minute of police arriving at the home. The video is graphic, it is disturbing, and it is revealing. Talking with Temple University professor and author Mark Lamont Hill, his new book is We Still Here. Zakiya Williams, head of the nonprofit organization Black Men Heal, and John Williams, head of the consortium, which is a mental health crisis response center. Zakiya, if I could go back to you and just help us understand the stigma, the shame, especially for Black men, when it comes to issues of mental health and mental illness.
Well, you know, I just recently watched an interview with the rapper DMX, and he talked about how, you know, talking about your feelings or just the thought of men knowing, other men knowing that you're going through something, is a very hard thing to do. You know, I'm also in school to get my license in therapy, but they teach us like different cultures. And one thing that I know about the Black culture is that, you know, what happens in this house stays in this house. That's like kind of what we were, you know, the things that a lot of us were raised on. So sometimes it's hard to talk about it. I mean, people have been starting, men have been starting to talk to like their barbers and things like that. But usually when men gather into these spaces that they have for themselves, they don't tend to talk about their feelings. You know, they talk about basketball or sports. I mean, this is a generalization, but it's not, it's looked, and just like, you know, as the gentleman who I'm so sorry for his loss, what happened to him, but it's just, it's not really a black thing. It can also be a male thing. You know, like I said, with me being in school, the statistics they have for the amount of depression or the amount of anxiety, most of the statistics say that women often suffer more. But what I'm learning is that it's not that women suffer more. Women are just express it more, whereas men, it's expressed in a different way for men. You know, so that's what. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on you there. I was just going to ask John White, does that make sense to you based on your experiences?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. It's ironic because with the COVID situation, the COVID crisis, there are a group of us who decided to have a happy hour every Friday evening. And it lasts for about an hour, and it's about 25 men on this call. And we're doing, it's almost like a wellness check for the entire group. And I have been pleasantly surprised that over the course of these calls, men have spoken up and talked about their feelings, talked about depression. And it struck me because the sister is right. Seldom when men gather do we talk about how we are feeling. And that's important. It's important to have that feeling of security and that community support. I'm not sure how you get past it other than to keep preaching the gospel. You know, mental health illness is, in fact, a health issue and needs to be addressed as such, not criminalized, and not something of which we ought to be ashamed when we have no control over, you know, how this all comes about.
Mark Lamont Hill, let me just shift gears here and talk about the fact that last week the police department did release excerpts of this video that we have been talking about. And Police Commissioner Outlaw said in response to releasing it, we are not releasing the body worn camera footage to try and change hearts and minds. We're doing it in the spirit of transparency to show that we're not hiding anything. I can't stress enough that we're not picking and choosing or cherry picking neighborhoods as a slight to any one particular area, and I have concern that some residents may feel that way, but I need them to know that wholeheartedly, not only is that not our intention, it is just not true. But I wonder, Mark, if you could just speak to the fact that, and my understanding is that this is pretty unusual to release this kind of body cam video, but nonetheless, the response of the police department to what's going on. And there are some ongoing investigations, we should say, from the district attorney's office and also the police department and others as well.
Yeah, I think this is why, you know, those of us who identify as abolitionists are very skeptical of certain types of police, of reform in general, but particular types of police reforms, not because we don't want to make people's lives better, but because there's a way that certain reforms will have us believe that a system that is unsustainable can just be tweaked, that it can become sustainable through these tweaks. And so, you know, the body camera is an example of that, right? I mean, the idea was if we could only have body cameras, if we could only see what police are doing at all times and police know that they're being watched at all times, the behaviors will change. And what we've seen is body cameras often just show us or allow us to watch police kill us. And the reason for that is because the problem with policing at the fundamental level isn't a bunch of bad apples. You know, that would actually be convenient and much easier to manage if every police department had some bad people and we could just find the bad people who do bad things and out them. Because most police officers who go to work every day aren't intending to kill anyone. They're not bad apples. They're people who work hard, who want to do their jobs. The problem is the job itself. Make certain demands. Even when you follow the rules and you follow the procedure, oftentimes those procedures and rules themselves are not the ideal or best way to respond to, again, our social crises and our needs. So, yeah, you know, the idea that we won't change hearts and minds by releasing this video, but we can be transparent, that's cool because the public can see exactly how it happens. And because the public itself is conditioned to believe that the only thing you can do when someone has a knife is shoot them. And if the public is intentioned to be scared and stigmatize mental illness, then yeah, they actually may change hearts and minds. Because again, the problem isn't that those police on the ground right there were bad apples. It's that they're part of a system that isn't capable of responding to our needs, and we need to reimagine what that is. And so we can applaud the commissioner for having more transparency than many police departments do. But the problem is, now that we see what they do, how can we change what they do?
Well, let me read a comment from Margaret, which is related to what you just said there, Mark Lamont Hill. She says, I learned that police are trained that citizens must obey a police order to drop a weapon, freeze, etc. If the citizen does not comply, the police are taught that they are in mortal danger and they must shoot to protect themselves. This training excludes any understanding of mental illness. Standing back, standing down would definitely protect a policeman from a mentally ill person with a knife. Police training must change. I wonder, John White, if you want to speak to what Mark Lamont Hill was saying, but also Margaret's comment as well. And I think we all agree that what happened should not have happened. The question is, you know, how do we change, reform the system so that if it happens again, it will result with someone's life being saved and also that they get the treatment that they need?
Mr. Hill is absolutely correct. We're trimming around the edges, thinking that that's going to change, the size of the hedge. It doesn't happen that way. This reform has to be from the inside out. I will appreciate the transparency that the police commissioner, exhibited by releasing the video. But at the same time, they stopped short of addressing some of the basic situations that can be avoided. There was no talk of additional police training in the field of mental health, providing mental health training to them or to the dispatchers. There was no talk about integrating behavioral health professionals into the police to assist and to advise in situations involving an individual with mental illness. It's no conversation about making sure that the police officers have the necessary tools and equipment to be able to perform their duties without shooting and killing someone who is standing more than a car length away from them with a 4-inch pocket knife. There's so much involved in this, so many different pieces, but it goes back to, does leadership have the will to make the systemic changes that are necessary to save lives as well as to protect lives?
Here's another comment, a tweet from Josie, and I'll put this to you, Zakiya Williams. She says, I wonder if there's a study on PTSD that police officers suffer after the senseless shooting of mentally ill citizens. It seems if we can discuss both and bring the police into these conversations, we may solve more. These tragedies must stop. Anything you want to say, Zakiya Williams, in response to either what Mark Lamont Hill was saying or John White or even our tweet from Josie?
Sorry. What I will say is that when people think that black men aren't affected by seeing their brothers gunned down in the street, they are. We have had a huge influx of applications of men that apply to Black Men Heal after these incidents, especially after George Floyd. It was a combination of COVID, of the racial uprising. And, before some of them would apply and say, oh, they were, depressed. Or now the reason that they say is specifically, the racial injustice, or they'll name Walter Wallace. They'll name it specifically. But as far as the PTSD piece, I think that it is prevalent on both sides. Again, I didn't watch the entire video because I just couldn't. But when I first turned it on and I saw the way that the cops were walking up to him, they themselves looked petrified. They looked like they were scared as well. I agree with both the men on the call. Something definitely has to be done by way of de-escalating the situation. But I think it all boils down to funding. Because, a lot of people that come through Black Men Heal, a lot of the men that come through, it's because they don't have insurance or they don't have adequate insurance that addresses their mental health needs. So I think it comes down to funding organizations like the consortium, having a relationship between those agencies and the police department. So I do believe that it comes down to funding.
And Zakiya, my understanding is that about 4% of psychologists in the American Psychological Association, APA, are people of color or are African American themselves. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. And that's one thing. Another piece of the puzzle for Black Men Heal, solution, is that not only do we cater towards black men, but we are helping black therapists build their practices. You know, when you go to your insurance card and you look on the back of the insurance card, they may take your insurance, but they don't look like you. And a lot of the men, that's one of the pieces that they like about what we do. They say, you know, well, I can relate to this person. I don't want to have to explain to them what systematic racism is or, you know, whatever. So we also take unlicensed clinicians so they can sit. They can get their hours to sit for licensure by taking the men from Black Men Heal.
You know,
Mark.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this John White? Yeah, go ahead, John.
She's right on point again. We're fortunate at the consortium because we are a culturally competent, diverse provider that have Black professionals up and down the ladder, psychiatrists, primary care physicians, PhD psychologists. But the training of the therapists and the funding for services such as ours is key. Now, at the consortium, we turn no one away. Because I personally have felt the sting of what happens when you turn your back on someone who is asking for help when help is available. So the insurance issue, I mean, what happens if the Supreme Court guts the Affordable Care Act?
Right, which is being heard today.
Exactly. There are millions of people who are able to access behavioral health services across this country as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Take that away. Then what are you dealing with? So I have enjoyed the conversation, and I've learned a lot by way of it. I just hope that our listening audience took note of
sure.
the concerns as we have laid them out, and hopefully they too will become advocates for people with mental illness.
Well, we're not done quite yet. And Mark, I want to read a comment from Vicky, who's not pleased with our conversation. Why do your panels consistently contain people who haven't had to respond to calls for armed people in crisis? It's easy to pass judgment from the safety of an office. I challenge your panel to work on the streets experiencing these things firsthand as they happen, as opposed to offering criticism after the fact. Can you, Mark, respond to what Vicky is saying?
Well, a couple things. I agree. I haven't done that job. And there's a really good chance that if I were being chased by someone with a knife, I might not de-escalate. I might not call a mental health person. I might shoot them too. And because I know that that's my instinct, I'm not a police officer. I'm not a first responder because I know that my response wouldn't be proper. And so I think when we make the decision to do these jobs, we are held to a higher standard because we're making a greater commitment to public safety. And it's an extraordinary commitment. It's one that I don't take lightly. It's one that I don't underestimate. But it's one that does come with an extraordinary burden. But I want to be clear. I think all of us today, but I'll speak for myself in particular, have spoken more about the systemic and structural issues. This isn't a George Floyd situation. This isn't Derek Chauvin, right? This isn't me saying this is a bad person who did a bad thing. It's me saying that police... My point was police shouldn't be called to the scene in the first place for a mental health crisis. My point is police should be given, what Mr. White said is part of it is them not having batons or tasers means that they were ill-equipped literally to respond to the crisis. And then, of course, as Zakiya is saying, there's a set of stigmas and structures in society, socially and culturally, that make us all stigmatize mental illness. So the issue here isn't picking on or beating up on, pardon the expression, law enforcement or other first responders. It's to say that the system itself has been created in a way where even if you have the best intentions and you do your absolute best, we haven't put you in a position to be successful. And to me, that's the bigger issue.
Well, you know, we have to leave it there. My thanks to all three of you for joining us on Radio Times. We could go on. Mark Lamont Hill, thank you so much. Nice to have you back on the show.
It was a pleasure.
And he's a professor of communications at Temple University, host of BET's News and Coffee and Books, owner of Uncle Bobby's Bookstore, which is in Philadelphia. And he has a new book, We Still Hear, Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. Zakiya Williams, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's co-founder, clinical program director of Black Men Heal. And John White, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. you very much.
You're very welcome. CEO and president of the consortium in West Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. And we have thousands of those for you to listen to. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.